This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Nothing really is, but things to stay the same, they have to change again. Hello, my old friend.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your industrial grade glycine of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Do you hear the totality of American musical history? I bet you do. It's American Requiem. It's Beyonce. It's Cowboy Carter. It's the Cowboy Carter episode. You knew it was coming. Joe and I talked about it on Deluxe a few days ago, but you know we had to come with the full episode. We are going to talk all things Beyonce this week. We're going to talk the specifics. We're going to talk some of the historical antecedents for this album. We are going to talk the discourse and the meta discourse, even the toxic parts. We're going to talk about all of it this week. I am joined by two people who are no strangers to podcast and no strangers to Beyonce. First, Julianne Escobedo Shepherd. Julianne, welcome. Hi, nice to see you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Julianne reviewed Cowboy Carter for Pitchfork, obviously a longtime Beyonce coverer in various publications. And also, she wanted me to underscore, the author of a forthcoming book about the American West. So when you start saying, Julianne, what do you know about rodeo? Julianne's going to tell you what she knows about rodeo, correct?
I've been to many rodeos. I've been to so many rodeos. I love the rodeo.
Yes. Yes. We all, everybody loves rodeo. Jesus, stop saying. Also, dialing in from Nashville, it's Marcus K. Dowling. Marcus, bienvenue.
Dang, it's good.
Marcus is a country music reporter from the Tennessean and has also spoken to several people involved in the album, people in the broader ecosystem of what's happening in Nashville, especially when it relates to the contemporary Black country music scene and Black Opry and et cetera. And we're going to talk a little bit about that as well. So right off top, we're going to go around and we're going to say what we think Cowboy Carter is out of 10. And the question is, why is it an 11?
Wow.
No, we're not gonna do that, but we're just having jokes. Writing about Beyonce, as many people know, can be critically fraught territory. And so we encourage everybody who's listening to this episode to understand that criticism is an act of love and generosity, not an act of shame. Something to keep in mind as everybody navigates their social media lives. Let's talk a little bit first about what felt to me like a tiny bit of a head fake. Which is, it's a country album, but then it's like, it's actually something a little bit different than a country album. And I think I was wondering about that messaging and how did you guys take the intent of the messaging and then square that with what the album actually ended up being, which I think is a lot more kind of nuanced and broadly curious than this sort of genre tag, as it were. I wonder how that struck y'all.
Well, I'll start. I'll say that there's two things that you have to think about when you think about anything dealing with Beyonce trying to make a country record, is that A, Blackness is not a monolith, and B, country music is not a monolith. And then number three, most importantly, Beyonce is a Texan. So a lot of my journalism here is going to be about the fact that a South Texan made a country album that plays upon all of the tropes of South Texas country music. And she's also a Black pop star who has touched every realm of Blackness in three decades. So amidst all of that, you get this Venn diagram that she, in 27 tracks, touches in every single format.
Yeah, I mean, I think the head fake was maybe a little bit deliberate to get people riled, and then also thinking about what she and Linda Martell put on the album about genre, and the fact that genre is a construct.
And certainly that contemporary. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that obviously the history of genre is really tied to anti-Blackness. So what are we doing here? So that's what it seemed to me to sort of be gearing towards.
Yeah, it seemed designed to shine a light on the narrowness of contemporary country music in the mainstream sense, and also the dialogues around contemporary country music, which if you think about how most people, excluding, of course, those on this show and our friends, but how many people discuss country music, they often don't discuss race at all. Race is considered a non-issue for a lot of people, I think, in the business.
I'll push back on that, John, and I'll say that whenever you discuss Beyonce and country music, it's literally racial because of what happened with her in 2016. And I think that that is one of the key formulation pieces to this, is that it's done explicitly and intentionally in relationship to feeling wholly excluded at the CMA Awards. And it's a response to that. And I think that's the part that was so key in the initial branding, is to put that front and center. In country music, I don't know if you know this, sometimes we don't say the quiet part out loud. Sometimes we keep the quiet part quiet.
No.
And specifically on this album, she said, like in Nashville, specifically Nashville, she said, I'm going to say the quiet part out loud from the beginning and put the entirety of the Nashville system fundamentally on alert and tell everybody to hide their head and watch their ass.
But then it's also very pointed in the finished product that music, frankly, doesn't have very much in common with what we think of as contemporary mainstream country music at all. It feels a 70s record to me. It's only in moments, you want to take the Post Malone record, there's little things here and there, and obviously there are places, especially later on the record, where I think she's nodding to some more forward thinking R&B adjacent tempo friendly versions of quote unquote mainstream country. But
so you want the Ice Spice remix of Sweet Honey Bucking is what you're telling me.
I'm saying if that's not already in the cooker, if that's not stewing right now,
right.
Then that's a problem. What I really want is I want some like Louisiana Bounce remixes.
I mean, yeah. You heard the pony up version of Texas Hold'em, right?
Actually, I haven't heard that.
Although you need to hear it.
There's some bounce on there. Yeah.
All right. Let's
literally the bounce remix of Texas Hold'em. And it's like,
yeah,
it's the most Texarkana sounding bounce record I've ever heard in my life. And I think that Texarkana bounce is the thing that needs to exist. And I'm happy that record did it. So it's really good, John.
All right. We're going to play a little bit of it now so that I can hear it and that everybody else can hear it. Woke up this morning. I want to also pick up on something that you jumped right to, Marcus, about Texas and Southern soul and how country, quote unquote, as a posture and as an attitude and as a framing has always been embedded in what Beyonce has done. It's always been, and it may not be as sort of like heavy handed from a style perspective as it is on this record, but it's always been part of the proposition. And I wonder if you could talk about how the quote unquote countryness of Beyonce has played out earlier in her career, prior to Daddy Lessons in the 2000s.
Yeah, she played the Texas Rodeo. She played the Houston Rodeo four times in the 2000s. I'd say that probably more so than winning an award or getting on the top 40 of the Hot 100 charts, being a native of Houston and getting invited to play in front of over 50,000 people at the rodeo is like a bellwether tent post accomplishment of her career. And she did it four times. She rode a horse.
She rode a horse. Insert Beyonce horse dot JPEG dot move dot MP4.
Exactly. I'll say this about Beyonce's career. It's funny. It's to me, even before making Cowboy Carter, she had achieved all of the initial Western and country tent posts of her lifetime as a Texan. And this record is more or less a conversation with Nashville, a conversation with the world, a conversation with stereotype. And that country lens is important because she's saying, A, I am country, and B, the rest of the world probably is too. And I'm going to show you where you are, and I'm going to pull you in and force you to understand that this thing that you probably don't understand in the last 5 years is taking over popular culture and music is yours as much as anybody else's.
As part of the press release or rollout, one of the things that Beyonce said is that this was originally intended to come out prior to Renaissance, that the order was originally the other direction. I wonder, do you think it would have hit differently or felt different if this had come out in whatever it was, 21 or 22? Do you think that a bunch of other things had to happen in order to set up the actual potency that it feels like it's hitting with right now?
Imagine, say, like the run of records that Morgan Wallen had in 2022 and 2023. You put like a spaghetti up against Broadway Girls or Cowboys or a 180 Freestyle on the most recent Morgan Wallen album. And it's a real conversation about street records, but that are country inspired. And it's, if Morgan Wallen is going to be a pop star, then Beyonce's certainly a pop star. And these are two pop stars having a battle at 20 paces in the middle of country music. And I think that that's a fascinating narrative, but I think that an easier narrative to paint than to jump right into race and right into culture is to let everybody party and put out like the best queer party records that pop has seen in 20, 30 years and say, let's have a conversation here and do that. And then we'll get back to the country record, because sure, there may be some more country records that'll come out in the interim, which they did. Which you had Fast Car, you had all of the moments with the 5 number one songs and that crossed over last year. And it's a big thing. And it's smart to put the country record out now, because now it's in conversation in a much more dominant narrative that Beyonce is comfortable in.
I wanted to just pick up on one thing you said, which is about Wallen. And obviously we could have a whole separate conversation about Wallen's career, but just to table that, the other stuff for now, but the notion of Wallen as pop star, which I think often there's a lot of resistance to, despite how popular he is, because his fame is relatively siloed. And I think people don't think of him, but also when we think of contemporary pop stardom, what I think we're often talking about are genre superstars with an expansive ear. And if you're going to call Drake a pop star, which a lot of people do, positively and negatively, you also have to talk about someone like Wallen as a pop star. And if you're going to talk about someone as like Wallen as a pop star, you have to look at someone like Beyonce, who starts as a pop star, and allow that same porousness to seep back into genre spaces. I think that's important. I think that has to be said.
It speaks a lot to vibe. If it had come out in 2020, 2021, it might have gotten lost a little bit, both because of the Wallen, but also because what it's saying, I think, is so aligned to certain conversations that this country was having in 2020, 2021. And honestly, she knew that we all needed a break. We all needed to go outside. And obviously, the political timing has been interesting. I keep thinking about just, she has this expansive vision of what America is, and maybe you could even argue what it could be, at the same time that Texas is currently fighting with the United States government to keep immigrants, literally fighting. And we're talking about this state that seceded when it wasn't even a state. And so I think that all of that context is really interesting too. I realize it's extra musical, but it just,
but is it? It's actually, but I think in the long run, in the long picture, it's not extra.
It's
and it
not
won't
extra.
Be. Yeah. Like 5 to 10 years from now, certainly all this stuff will be in music somewhere.
I wish that she would drop a syllabus. Like, I really want to see books on the Beyonce.com/shop page, because I know that she must be reading some stuff, or someone around her is reading stuff. And And we need the syllabus.
No, she's done the homework. And that's, yes. I want to, before we jump in, because I want to talk about some specific songs, but I do want to add one thing. And this is also for listeners. I think we can say pretty straightforwardly that out of all contemporary pop stars across genre, dispositions, backgrounds, whatever, almost no one, if not no one, is making work in the manner that Beyoncé is making work. The sort of depth and complexity of reference, the sort of narrative and meta narratives, like we could talk about whether it's a Drake or whoever, or Wallen or whatever, like anybody who's like comparably popular, those people are making songs by and large. They're songs I like a lot of the time, but they are making songs. This album is functioning on a different level. And I think it's even before we go into kind of getting in the weeds on certain individual tracks or lyrics, or even it's worth just mapping that out up front and saying this nature of album it has an intricacy that I don't know, maybe this is like a silly way to think of it, but I think of like complex indie rock in the 90s, or like people like conceptual prog rock records or whatever, like records that are emphatic about their meta narratives, which I just don't think you get loads of today in the contemporary pop space. That's a level that she's working on. So that's always going to be at the front of the conversation, I think.
I'll say to that point that there hasn't been ever in the history of mainstream country music a record that dominates the narrative that comes from a feminized, marginalized, and radical position, literally ever. This is there is no other record that is comparable to Beyoncé's record in the history of country music. You could say that there are other women have made records, and certainly there are. Like, there's a Miranda Lambert catalog in her early career that you could say is that sort of thing. But Miranda Lambert is not a 32-time Grammy-winning African-American female pop star who has cognizant understanding of multitudes of country, folk, Western, bluegrass traditions.
I'd love to have each of us talk about a specific song that really, really jumped out, especially on early listen, and talk a little bit about some of the unusualness of some of this music. Julianne, do you have something that jumped to your mind on first listen that really stuck with you?
I love Daughter. The thing with Daughter is that if she is responding to this sort of institutional rejection of her as a Black woman and as a quote-unquote pop star, although you made the great point that Morgan Wallen is also a pop star, when she feels like she has something to prove, she will always go the extra mile because she is thorough and she is studied and she is constantly reaching towards the best. And so when you hit the opera, I mean, my first thought was just like, they got her singing opera. Like, Nashville is deceased. Nashville being the term for, obviously, the corporate country music industry. But it's just that. And then also the sort of the beauty of Blackbird. I mean, you can look at covering Blackbird as a huge flex, but the context within it and just the sound of all of these voices of lesser known Black women in country music, the whole thing just gave me chills. The harmonies, the vocal production, the execution, and then just the history behind it. But once you get to the opera.
Yeah, a couple of things. One, like I did spend a bunch of time earlier today looking at TikToks from opera singers talking about this section of Daughter, right? Because look, I'm a perfectly capable music critic. I've listened to a lot of records, but my opera ear is not terribly tuned. So I was curious, like, what opera singers, or at least opera singers who are brave enough to make TikToks, thought about this part of Daughter. And I was struck most of them really, really were complimentary of it. There were also some interesting historical context about this particular song and where it functions in its opera, and that it's not meant to be quite as overpowering. It's maybe a little bit, it originally was delivered with a little bit more intimacy and a little bit more sort of like soft melisma. And so the sort of tone that Beyoncé is reaching for is actually pretty in keeping with how it was originally intended quote unquote, in the earliest incarnations of it. And it's not like the most bombastic of all opera singing. It's actually sort of more in tune with how that song was originally intended to be developed. But I felt like I had to check in on that as someone who doesn't know loads about opera. Let's listen to a little bit of Daughter, including some of that opera section.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
I use the New York Times Games app every single day.
I love playing Connections.
With Connections, I need to twist my brain to see the different categories.
I think I know this connection. Look, Bath is a city in England, Sandwich is a city in England, Reading is a city in England, and I'm going to guess Derby is a city in England.
I started Wordle 194 days ago, and I haven't missed a day.
The New York Times Games app has all the games right there.
I absolutely love Spelling Bee. I always have to get genius.
I've seen you yell at it and say, that should be a word.
Totally should be a word.
Sudoku is kind of my version of lifting heavy weights at the gym.
At this point, I'm probably more consistent with doing the crossword than brushing my teeth.
When I can finish a hard puzzle without hints, I feel like the smartest person in the world.
When I have to look up a clue to help me, I'm learning something new.
It gives me joy every single day.
Start playing in the New York Times Games app.
You can download it at nytimes.com/gamesapp.
Daughter, to me, is also one of my favorite songs on this by far. And one of the reasons I like it so much, I really like the lyrics. I really like the cadence of how she's sort of parceling out the lyrics. There are a few songs on this album that I think could work really effectively on earlier Beyoncé projects as well. They don't feel like kind of as tightly bound to the concept of this album. And this is one of those records. Like if this had been on, I don't know, self-titled or Lemonade, like in some form, it probably would have been fine. Like it probably would have made sense too. I didn't love Blackbird, but that's,
Sorry. I must relate to you an anecdote about Blackbird.
Oh no.
Yes, Marcus.
That's okay. I'm a free thinker. I'm allowed to have my skepticisms.
You are, but sometimes opinions are wrong.
No.
But that's okay. But I'll tell you why. So Friday morning, I spoke to, along with Cashay DeClay, because in the Gannett network of newspapers, we have a USA Today Beyoncé reporter, Cashay DeClay. She's a Howard University graduate. We spoke with Tanner. We spoke with Raina Roberts. And we spoke with Tiara Kennedy. Brittany Spencer was booked and busy preparing for the CMT Music Awards, or else she would have been there too. I spoke to them in the morning. That night, they had a party at Acme Feed and Seed, the bar, at the lower end of Lower Broadway, where they were celebrating a Beyoncé album release with a full party in the middle of a Lower Broadway Nashville honky-tonk. Now, at the upper end of Broadway, that's where I was. Cashay was down there. I was up at the upper end of Broadway as Shaq, DJ Diesel, was doing a dubstep set at the Sky Deck. And he played a heavy bass remix of Buckle Bunny by Tanner Adel. And Tanner Adel ran out on stage. And the whole crowd screamed because they knew who she was. Most people did not know who she was probably 12 hours before.
Just before you drag me, Tanner Adel's album was on my top albums list last year. Buckle Bunny is one of my biggest songs of last year. Like, I don't need to be told about Tanner Adel or Raina Roberts.
You were not in Nashville on a night where black women ran Lower Broadway. In real life.
Mm-hmm.
It was wild. It's unprecedented. I'd almost say it was unprecedented. And it was incredible. To me, the song actually, that is my favorite on the record, is Spaghetti.
Wait, can I just ask one question before you go to spaghetti? No problem, would you not have liked to see these particular singers, these Black women singers, get even more breathing space on this album?
I think that if you want to talk about Beyoncé as a person, we'll get to this spaghetti too, who has existed as an outlier in the Black country developing artist community for the last 15 years, because she couldn't be actively a part of it because she was busy being a pop star. But every time she looks around, there's Willie Jones on X Factor. There's Shaboozy doing Jeff Gordon in 2014. There's every single artist that's on this record breaking virally via TikTok or via Twitter at the time or via Facebook, like Kane Brown. And Beyoncé probably wanted to have something to do with that, but she can't. So when you get the opportunity to be in community with people that you have watched from afar, you find ways to do it that show you as being, well, in community. So doing a 5-part vocal harmony seems to make sense in that regard. To me, well, I say that it's the easiest way to do it. But I'll say that Gotti's cool because you take somebody like Shaboozy. Shaboozy's from Woodbridge, Virginia. I'm from Washington, D.C., so I've known about Shaboozy for a very long time. So the idea that he's gone from making cool indie pop tracks, he had a song called Jeff Gordon, where he was wearing the Jeff Gordon NASCAR jacket in 2014. And he was like a guy who wore cowboy hats just on the regular, like humbly. And his career has veered into rock and other stuff. And he's on this track that's like a club banger, for lack of a better term. It is a modern mainstream urban, quote unquote, music club banger.
Yeah, and he's vocalizing like Future or whoever.
On the same track with Linda Martell, who's talking about genre in a way that if you've ever talked to Linda or her granddaughter, is very much in the phrasing and style and way of knowing everything, but glad that you're coming along to learn sort of way that she's talking about a thing she's known about genre for about 50 years. So it's a cool little moment because you get all of these intermingling conversations and desires to broaden a conversation and be in community with people happening on one song that, in my mind, it's a song that probably should have existed in 2010 or 2012 or whatever. But we get this kind of like retroactive conversation that's happening at multiple points throughout the record where Beyoncé's, okay, I'm finally here, guys. And these are all the records that I wish that I would have seen that you guys probably wish you would have made at some point, probably at some point in the last 10 to 20 years.
That's an interesting way to think about this album. You're seeing it as like an omnibus collection of ideas that could have been generated at any point in the last, at various points, I should say, in the last 10 or 15 years.
I swear to God, if you talk to Miko Marx or you talk to Reese Palmer or you talk to Brittany Spencer about recording songs with various other people, these are songs that have probably existed in B-sides and outtakes and cuts that didn't make records for a long time. And that's the fascinating thing about, like I said earlier, about making a feminized, marginalized, and radicalized record at the forefront, is that these are records that Nashville would have never put on a record. Never. And because Beyoncé is at the controls, demonstrably, with Raphael Sadiq as the producer for most of these, and Timbaland in there, and Pharrell too, and some other folks, but Raphael's handling a lot of the work. Like, this is a smart person handling these great records, and that's what makes it pop.
Before we get off spaghetti, one thing I did want to underscore about that song, and I don't want to speculate about what Act 3 is going to be, but like one thing that Beyoncé has been doing quite a bit in the last few years is rapping. And there's just a lot of good rapping on this song. And the more I've listened to it, the more this particular song, there's rapping later on the record that's really good. This song, I think, is growing on me. There's just a lot of really good rapping. And to get back to what you were saying, Marcus, about threading the needle / connecting the bridge from Linda Martell to Shaboozy, it's interesting that that's what Beyoncé chooses for a significant part of the vocal approach that she's taking to tell that story.
I ain't in no gang, but I got shooters and I bang, bang. Snap of my fingers, I'm Thanos. And I'm still on your head, cornrows.
They call me the captain, the catwalk assassin. When they know what's snapping, then here come the yapping. All of this snitching and all of this lipping. Just a fishing expedition, dumb admission in the kitchen, cooking up some chickens, extra leg.
I wonder, how do you guys feel about rapping and how hip hop plays on this record? Because she does bring it out, especially towards the back end of the record. I wonder what part of the story you think it's telling.
It's so funny because it feels like just yesterday we were having national conversations about Cowboy Troy. And like, you know,
we've been playing chicken with the train. We're playing chicken with the train.
There was legitimately a time in like music discourse where the idea of like country hip hop was like a five alarm. What's happening? We must figure it out. And
I've written a lot of those pieces.
Yes, you were you were at the forefront.
Team early.
But it feels so absurd now, and I think a lot of the rapping, I kept thinking about rap as a Southern country genre, even though obviously it isn't historically. Let me rephrase that. Even though its origins aren't necessarily of the South, everyone knows happy 50th anniversary to hip hop in the Bronx. There's something so specifically Southern, not only to the rap that is popular now, but just to the sort of, I don't know, the sort of deeper roots of it.
Yeah, and I mean, also her rapping is... It's UGK-ish rapping. It's Ball and G rapping. Yeah, that's her rap.
We have to make sure that we keep this very Texas. OG Ron C has been doing chopped and screwed Southern rock and country mixtapes for well over a decade. So, and if you look at Big X the Plug, if you look at Mexican OT, all of these rappers who are coming out right now from the South, they are all wearing square-toed boots. They're all wearing Edsons. It's a perfect synergy. And I think that if you're going to try to make a hot record, and Beyonce is honestly trying to make legitimately, like, while making a country album, she's also Beyonce, so she has to make, like, the hottest record in every street. So if you're going to try to do that, you know that the next wave of where this heads. And I mean, you talk to Jelly Roll. He talks about the Southern guys all the time because he himself is a Southern rapper. So there's this like extended Southern rap thing that's happening right now that if Beyonce was not in conversation with it, she would not be doing her dead level best to make sure that she is making a record that is hot in every street right now.
I absolutely agree. And the song that I was going to pick to talk about for the sort of optimal song, I did talk about it. It's very much in this mode, though, which is Two Hands to Heaven. But I talked about it on Deluxe a little bit, so I think I'm not going to talk about it here that much. But it does sort of it does weave very cleanly with a lot of what we're talking about right now. Instead, I kind of want to talk about maybe a very obvious song. Obvious because it came out before the album and was discussed to death. And I don't mean Texas Hold'em. I mean 16 Carriages. So let's listen to just a bit of 16 Carriages for a sec.
$16 working all day. Ain't got time to waste. I got art to make. I got love to create. On this holy night, they won't dim my light. All these years I fight. It's been 38 summers and I'm riding my bed on the back of the bus and I'm bunk with the band.
The questions around retirement have gotten tiring. Instead of, have you saved up enough? Shouldn't they be asking, what is it that you love to do? You're not slowing down, so your retirement plan should be more of an action plan, a hiking plan, a golf plan. Lincoln Financial has the products to help protect and grow your financial future. Make your pastimes last a lifetime at LincolnFinancial.com/action plan. Lincoln Financial Group, marketing name for Lincoln National Corporation and its insurance companies and broker-dealer affiliate. Lincoln Financial Distributors, Inc., 2024, Lincoln National Corporation.
Now, when those two singles came out, or pre-release songs, whatever we're calling things these days, Texas Hold'em is the obvious poppier song. It's the more up-tempo one. It's the catchier one. And I thought, putting those two side by side, 16 Carriages felt a little dry by comparison. Then pressing play on this album, American Requiem into Blackbird, yes, or whatever, but then into 16 Carriages, I like damn near flipped my computer, because it absolutely, the grandeur of what the whole project is really comes into focus. And one of the things that I like so much about 16 Carriages is the embedded authority of the singing. And there's not too, there's things happening with the kind of dynamics of the production. There's not loads happening with production, especially compared to some of the songs we've just been talking about. But there is so much authority in the vocal on 16 Carriages that it really, to me, that's when the album starts for me. Like, I liked the two songs prior, but like when I heard that, I was like, oh, we are off to the effing races right now. Like, this hits hard. And it also, it doesn't call, like, maybe the thing that didn't quite work about it for me as a single is it doesn't call loads of attention to itself, whereas Texas Hold'em does call a lot of attention to itself. But to me, 16 Carriages doesn't. But when you're hearing it in this full context, it absolutely resonates and throbs.
I'm going to give you a little cute little story from Nashville. There's a lot of cute little stories happening in Nashville right now.
Yeah, we could just do like 20 minutes on you just giving us the tea, just like the gossip, the street gossip on this stuff.
So last year during CMA Fest, the Country Music Association did a white party, an all white party. It was all black people dressed in white. It was like a summer enjoyable event. And we came out and everybody's in the room and the DJ started to play every R&B song. And just the point of the night, the DJ was trying to play some country stuff, but there isn't a broad catalog of broadly known African-American country music that you could play. So he just started playing R&B. And there's a fun moment where all of these diva level vocalists who are at this event just start singing DeBarge in the middle of the room. And when you listen to 16 Carriages, it seems weird because it's on a country album. But if you actually hang around, this is the proof of Beyonce's understanding of the culture. It's like if you hang around a room with five or six black women who can sing country music and you play R&B, like they're going all the way in and it's going to be sanctified and gospel and just the biggest, most overwrought vocals you can imagine. And it was wild because it was like you're worried about the crossover of like this moment. Well, I'm sure it's something we'll get to later, but it's like the crossover of this moment to broader black culture. And then you see a moment like that and you're like, well, if we just put a camera on this and didn't tell people that it was a country music get together for African-Americans in the country space, then you'd just be like, oh, it's a barbecue. Oh, it's a graduation party. Oh, it's a cabaret. And that's the fun part, is that there's this narrative space that country music holds that's been absent for 50 to 75 years. And that's the thing with even like speaking to the sequencing of the record. That's why it's sequenced that way, because you want to welcome people back to a thing that if your family is old enough and Southern enough, you have people in your family that will tell you about the fact that there were country records that were part of the black vernacular of their time. And to do that is to say to every auntie, every godmother, every grandmother, every great grandmother, that this record is for you too. And it should probably be for you first.
One thing that I thought I haven't seen as much conversation about that I'd like to see is how Beyonce deploys her choices of, whether it's the Jolene cover or the Beach Boys thing or the Nancy Sinatra thing, like these feel pointed in two ways. One, a black pop star covering these sort of like sacred, basically like white heritage music at this point.
Yeah.
And it does feel pointed. And one thing I talked about in Deluxe is that I wonder if there's a little bit of like for Grammy voters, oh, is this what it's going to take? Do you need me to hear me cover the Beatles to do that? Do you need me to remake Jolene? Okay. I've made me wonder about that. But I'm curious how those choices, these big songs, whether through cover or through reference, woven into this narrative? How did they strike you? Because also, and you talk about how Beyonce is like on top of multiple narratives at the same time. To me, it also happens to fit very neatly with what's been happening in pop for the last 2 or 3 years of like very obvious covers, very obvious samples as a way of expanding your tent, or maybe for some lesser artists, not being sure if you belong in the tent in the first place and finding an easy, fast way in. I don't think that's what Beyonce is doing, but it is, I think, very striking how she deploys some of these songs. And I wonder what you think the message is in picking some of this material, whether it's for cover or for interpolation.
It feels to me like she's just sort of weaving this tapestry of American popular music through her eyes and making the point that these are songs that are sort of as the songs that she's making, the songs that she's referencing are as American as Good Vibrations or whatever, and decentering this idea that that's American popular music and saying, no, all of this is American popular music. That's what I felt listening to that.
For me, it's I watch a lot of blaxploitation movies. And there's a moment where you look at these films and they're all made in the 70s and there are definitely black people wearing cowboy boots in the middle of Harlem. It's just a thing. And Beyonce is almost saying to black people, almost explicitly, that it's okay, so I made this country record. Yeah, but you don't get it? Here's Willie Nelson. Here's Dolly Parton. Here are all these obvious whiter than white, mainstream as mainstream can be, touchstones that tell you that if you want to wear cowboy boots in the middle of Harlem again, it's really okay. Because I am in conversation for you with everybody that you would theoretically need to have in conversation aligned so that you don't feel culturally awkward or unaware.
Marcus, that point about essentially creating a safe space narrative to re-import this stuff back into the black music conversation and potentially the black style conversation and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it. Is there was a whole like fashion piece to this rollout too. And I think it's incredibly important in the sense that like one of my favorite conversations on social media so far, and also just in my DMs and in my real life, because I live in Nashville, is how expensive Western culture is.
Oh, to like actually buy the clothes?
Yeah, because it's like, you look like all of my friends who want to be cool are like, wait, well, Beyonce is wearing this piece and that piece. And Marcus, a nice Western shirt is like $225 or something. And I'm like, yeah. And
they're
like,
yeah, we pulling up to Manuel. Like we got to, you got to do it right.
So I explained to people that there is a certain excellence that exists in engaging with this culture that's a double, it's a positive double bind, if that's even a thing. I'm trying to find another way to say it, but I think that's one of the positives of it, is that it upsells itself as just like extraordinary extravagance and extraordinary excellence. And one of the fascinating parts of that is that I tell my friends, I say, well, if you can't buy the shirt, at least understand the music and understand like the qualities of excellence that exist for black people in this music and the qualities of excellence that exist for black people in this culture. You could talk about like the Compton Cowboys. You could talk about black people who create the Girl is Yeehaw agenda, or like somebody like Taylor Crump, the writer, who is out there like engaging in discourse and creating things that can be consumable that don't require you to spend like $250 on a Western shirt. And I think that that's going to be the fascinating trickle down of it, is that the aesthetic isn't going to be as much top down. Everybody's going to suddenly adapt fashion. But I think that everybody's going to adapt understanding and a willingness to want to engage in conversations about how black country, black Western culture expands on a street level.
I was watching something on, I don't know, Peacock or Hulu or something, and some ad pops up, and it's a Lucchese ad, right? It's a boot ad. But you don't see who the person is. You just see the boot, and then it's some scenes or whatever, and then you start pulling back, and at the end of the ad, it's a black woman. And I was like, I don't know if Lucchese has been doing ads with black women for 10, 20 years, and just no one is, it hasn't been brought up. But I was like, what a very striking choice in this particular cultural moment. Now, to Marcus's point, Lucchese is going to run you about 1200 to 1600. Yeah. So you can find, although I will say from personal searching, you can get a decent bear for about 200 to 400 on eBay if you're looking carefully. But just, I was very struck by that. Sorry, Julianne, what were you about to say?
I was just going to point out and shout out Brie Malandro, who coined the term Yeehaw Agenda back in 2018. When this first started, this conversation first started becoming really mainstream with Old Town Road. And Brie on the Yeehaw Agenda Instagram has been chronicling this sort of, you know, exactly what you're talking about, Marcus. Mary J. Blige in full cowboy regalia. And as she's been doing this, she's gotten deeper and deeper into the actual history of black cowboying in Texas. And that's the thing that I find really interesting with this album, is just how deep it sort of asks you, invites you to go with actual history, the history of black cowboys in Texas, and the history of the Bill Pickett Rodeo. It goes so deep, and it's a shame and a pox. Something that people aren't taught this stuff in public schools. This is all American history. And I think that here comes Beyonce again, doing what the government won't do.
But,
God damn it.
But this is, but to your point about curriculum earlier, Julianne, like this, I'm sort of inherently a little resistant to like the footnoting of music, like kind of like, and this is that, and this is that. Like, I understand that's valuable. I'm a little resistant to it from an aesthetics perspective, but I do think, you know, music this layered and also recovering so much buried history. Yeah, it wouldn't be bad to see a little bit of a booklet to go with that to really map it out.
I tell people this about country. It's a thing that I've realized. Country music is a steel-girded foundation upon which stands a straw man who then is on top of a stick-made bridge, and there is a log cabin on top of that bridge, and then there is people and things that are impacting that space. And the straw man's allowed to bend. This is an extended metaphor, but it works. The thing that happened is that we've never had a black woman on top able to step down with force. A black woman stepped down with force on top of the whole thing. And I think the fascinating thing that's left for the country music industry is that the only thing that's left are the steel beams. Everything else is broken. Like in the space of one night, like, everybody woke up and said, like, I'll put it out there. Like, Luke Bryan said that the Cowboy Carter album was good. Lainey Wilson said that the Cowboy Carter album was good. Post Malone said it's on the Cowboy Carter album.
But I wonder, just to pick up on that, do you think anybody in any famous person in Nashville would say that it's not good? Or is there going to be like some Al Dean interview where he goes in on it? What's going to happen?
I'll say this. I went to go see Oliver Anthony Music.
Oh, yeah.
At the Ryman Auditorium. Oliver Anthony Music, who...
My guy.
Know, yeah, the guy who said that people who are 5'3" and 300 pounds don't deserve to eat fudge rounds on a folk
song. A complicated individual, mm-hmm. Oliver yes. Anthony Music.
And I will say that there was a white woman buck dancing on stage at the Ryman Auditorium during his show.
There we go.
I have seen more white people buck dancing in Nashville in the last 12 months that I've seen black people buck dancing in Nashville. I've seen more black people playing acoustic guitars and cognizant of the history of all of these ancillary genres to country music than probably I've seen mainstream white country artists being in conversation with that.
And also, this is where, like, when I talked earlier about this feeling like a 70s album or like even a 60s in some place, like, it's what's interesting is to me what that says, or what I feel like Beyonce's saying is, if you want to be in dialogue with this music, if you want to be embraced, you actually can ignore what's happening right now. You don't have to look, the thing that you are in quote unquote competition with, or in colloquy with, or fellowship with, or whatever it is, it actually doesn't have to be this stuff. It can be older stuff. It can be aesthetically different stuff. It can be the four-letter word of Americana. It could be any of those things. It does not have to be what the vast majority of people currently think of as country music. And if that's the main takeaway intervention from this project, that's great. That's huge. And I think probably a relief to a lot of performers who have not found contemporary Nashville to be a hospitable place for what the type of music that they want to make.
I'd say the only issue with what you stated, and there's one major issue with it, is that there are no cultural spaces that allow for those communities that are excited by the music that they're hearing online to engage in conversation in public together in groups of more than 500 people.
Like on stages, you mean?
Yeah,
like
in stages, festivals, events. Those don't exist.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. So obviously, we've talked a little bit about Black Opry on the show previously. There's obviously communities of musicians and of allies who are trying to help amplify people who have been working in this space for years and years and years. I wonder, especially being in Nashville, can you talk a tiny bit and tie it into what you just said about what is the next 6 months look like? What is the next 12 months? Are we heading in a direction that's different than we would have been heading in otherwise?
So I'll relate to something I was saying earlier today. I was talking to Alice Randall earlier today. She has a book out and an album out next week. Whenever this drops, it drops April 9th and April 12th. And it's called My Black Country. And she's the first Black woman to have a writing credit on a number one mainstream country single with X and O's with I'm a Trace Berg in the 1990s. And she's got 40 years of history. She's great. But we're talking about the idea that the moment needs to be created where people are able to verticalize engagement. Like, this always has happened in like a song here, a moment there, a thing here. And in the last 5 years, because of groups like the Black Opry, started by Holly G in 2021, ish, and now they play routinely in front of 200 to 500 cap venues and are part of the broader mainstream country conversation when it comes to marginalized people and people of color. But the verticalness of that is the fascinating part, because you've never had multiples of things happening in broad daylight in big community, and there hasn't been that verticaling of what that needs to look like. And I'm interested to see what that looks like. Like, what does a 1500 cap venue look like with all Black people on stage and people expressing the dynamic of culture that Beyonce has opened? What does it look like, you know, to have Nissan Stadium, where if Beyonce were to tour again, what would that look like? What would the demographic of that crowd be? Would it be a bunch of country people? Would it be Beyonce fans? Would it be people who are interested and are sitting there, and would they cheer? Would they boo? Would they respond? What would happen?
Do you feel like part of the takeaway of this month or 6 months is it's coalescing into something?
I'm going to say the most obvious, ugly part of the thing, because that's why I'm here, I guess.
Yeah, that's why we're here.
Somebody's got to get in the top 10 on country radio. Somebody.
Who's not Beyonce?
No, it should have been Beyonce. Like, if you play the math right, like, she had the number one selling song in country music, but she's still in the low 30s, top 40s on country radio. So there's a conversation that needs to be had. And it probably, I had a conversation with Darius Rucker about this too. And Darius Rucker has a memoir coming out. And one of the things that Darius will tell you is that he toured over 130 country radio stations across America when he had a debut country single in 2008. And this is Darius Rucker of Hootie and the Blowfish having to fundamentally go station to station with largely white country DJs and reintroduce himself. Yes, there's a level of crazy, ridiculous, absurd humility that no person who has that level of excellence in music already should have to go through. But the walk back off of that is that country music is 100 years old and country music doesn't need anything, but it certainly wants stuff.
But to that point, like, obviously Beyonce is not going to do a knocking door tour of country music radio station. We know that. No, she's not going to do it. And to your point, that paid off for Darius. I mean, this is a very different era. I mean, we're already talking 16 years. Paid off for Darius. It paid off for Kane Brown in the way that Kane Brown did it. But something that I think is fundamentally different about the last few years, and especially about some of these singers that we've been talking about, Tanner Adele, Randa Roberts, so on and so forth, so much of the early breakthrough is direct to consumer, right? It's on TikTok, it's on Instagram. And so audiences are being found in what are fundamentally parallel spaces, or maybe lightly overlapping Venn diagram spaces to the quote unquote mainstream country radio audiences. And so I think if I'm a singer and I'm like, I'm finding my people, they're finding me, I'm finding them, I don't want to do the 100. But then does that create essentially a wall where singers who come up through the traditional system are going to mostly still be white, and because they're still doing all the stuff that country radio expects, and then any non-white or hell non-male singer, or heaven forbid non-straight singer, right, coming up in other is just going to be like, I'm going to come up in a parallel space, and that's just has to be okay. And then country will essentially remain in lockstep as it's been the center of the genre.
So that's what I mean about creating community and creating verticalizing space, is that if there is an established order to the way that country's mainstream operates, which is true, there is an established order. It works. If it didn't work, then that'd be a different conversation. On a very fundamental, not progressive,
it operates.
Right, it operates, and there's billions of dollars being made every year, and there's people that are very wealthy and are enshrined in halls of fame who have succeeded at this system. But there is now a space, an enormous space, commercially viable space that says, maybe there's another way we could do this to support the fact that people are buying this music. Maybe if they don't want to engage with the existing system, they are certainly buying it en masse. They are engaging with it en masse. They are making TikTok videos with it en masse. What does that verticalize into? What does that look like on a festival level? What does that look like on a marketing level? What does that look like on an industrial level? Who are the kind of people who need to be hired? Who are the kind of people who need to work? What does that look like as a fundamental industry that stands ultimately alongside an existing order that has worked for the better part of almost 80 years?
But do you think being in Nashville, having conversations with folks who are frankly on both sides of this, right? Do you think the people who are on the conventional, this is how we've always done it side, are hearing the knocking or the party happening next door and being like, we should get involved?
There is neither the time in the day, because these are all industries that take 12 to 16 hour workdays. So there's not the time in the day to sit down and understand how to recreate create a plug-in to the system to make the TikTokers work or to make marginalized people work. If we had 36 hour days, of course we'd be solved, but we do not. So in my mind, what this looks like is that there is an established industry. Maybe there are artists who will engage with that industry eventually. By happenstance, accidents happen every day. But there's also a side that says that there are enough people now who are moderately to majorly interested in the concept that Beyonce has presented to the world of what diverse, dynamic, broad-based, quote-unquote, country music can be, that is a whole industry unto itself that could stand right next to this established system. And then the two of them start to have conversation with each other. This is my magical thinking, and I apologize up front.
But this is like the before the record came out, the piece I wrote was like, will country welcome Beyonce? That's the wrong question. Because like on a fundamental level, that's not what she wanted. And it's not something that they are going to do because they're going to ask for it on their terms. So it was never going to happen. But you think side by side, two separate things that maybe at some point in the future will start kind of flirting with each other.
And I think that it's a situation where people have to look at what is working on the ground in Nashville as far as creating interest and intrigue and provocation towards wanting to do something else. So like anything that like CMT and M Theory are doing, things that the Academy of Country Music are already doing, Country Music Association are doing, things that the Black Opera are doing, things that Whiskey Jam, for crying out loud. Let's make sure we mention Whiskey Jam in this conversation too. There's stuff that's happening on the ground that is provoking people's interest. There's something that needs to come along, something, someone, an entity that elevates that and says, this is valuable. And the second you create value in industry, then there's a conversation where country music's establishment could look and go, maybe you need another Beyonce single. Maybe. Because then maybe we'll give it a shot at radio.
Okay. I have one other topic I want to touch on, but I do want to also, I want to shout out something that I think, I'm sure everybody on this call, this show knows about, but I think maybe a lot of people don't know about, which is there's a box set from the late 90s called From Where I Stand, The Black Country Music Experience, or The Country, The Black Experience, From Where I Stand, The Black Experience of Country Music. 3-CD set, which has a lot of important early records. And if you're looking for something to understand some of this deeper history, to Julianne, to your point, some kind of curricular side thing, right, to have in reference, there's some fascinating stuff on that compilation.
Stay in touch with the Country Music Hall of Fame Museum too, because
they're doing a thing, right?
Really, they are for sure. I don't know at what point this is going to be a thing, but they are doing a lot more scholarship and work in that direction, even before Cowboy Carter, Alice Randall's book, whatever, were things. So there is a broader conversation that is being had for sure at that level.
All right. The last thing I want to talk about is like, we spent a lot of time talking about country music and Nashville and who's knocking on whose door and who's listening and who's allowed to sing what and who wants to feel empowered to sing what and so on and so forth. Let's bring it back to Beyonce for a second. Let's bring it back. And I don't want to speculate about what Act 3 is. That's fine. That's for the internet. I'm not worried about that. But I do want to talk about Beyonce's stature as a star right now, the type of records that she is now, I think, expected to deliver. As a, like, the idea of Beyonce like releasing like a tossed off record, like a casual, like, I just got in the studio for a week and a half and like we just banged out 8 songs. Like, that seems not likely that will happen. I wonder if we could talk about where does Beyonce go from here? Because a thing that I talked about previously is you have Beyonce like the hitmaker era, like 2000s into the early 2010s. And now I feel like we're in Beyonce, the conversation starter era, the kind of, I am going to use this music as an opportunity to tell you a deeper historical truth. And there are many historical truths that need to be told. I wonder, as Beyonce's in, is she 40? I mean, that's a great age. 42, great age. Great age. But as she moves through her 40s and beyond, I wonder what you guys think about the type of records or the type of positioning that she's going to have moving forward. What do we think? Because I feel like what Renaissance and Cowboy Carter set the table for is a very different kind of career mode than even what Lemonade or Self-Titled set table for. And so I'm curious what you think the next few years will hold.
This is so wild because she's been positioning herself as sort of this archivist, this like sort of oracle and keeper of all of and translator of all of these huge ideas. And she keeps setting her bar higher and higher with the past few albums. I can't even fathom what it could be. I mean, she's obviously sort of experimenting with this idea of genre and these sort of modes of different types of popular music.
That's sort of what I'm wondering. Like, you think it's going to continue with albums in this kind of modality?
I think after Act 3, whatever it may be, I think she's going to take a long break. The thing with Renaissance...
Who amongst us?
Who amongst us? I know, believe it. I know, that's... It's perhaps quite obvious.
Yes.
But, you know, this idea of the Renaissance, the Acts 1 through 3, they really do sort of... It seems like she thinks she's resetting herself. And I would be surprised if she comes with an answer in the next like 15, 20 years. Like I can't even fathom how she could set her bar higher unless she does just drop an opera album, which why not?
Marcus, what do you think? Do you think that this modality is now the Beyoncé modality going forward?
No, I think that she's doing a cool little thing. No, it's a cool little thing.
Wow.
That's tight. Nice little thing you got there. Nice little side hobby you got there.
Yeah, it's cool. So there's these moments in popular music where people who are smarter than you in the room will tell you that you're making a song that already existed, that everybody forgot. And I think that she essentially got tired of hearing about all of these songs that everybody forgot. And she's making all of the songs that fill in all of the holes in the Black popular musical canon. So by the time that she's done with whatever this third record will be, you'll be able to look at the Black musical canon and everywhere where there is a gap. Like if you're a fan of Tina Turner Turns the Country On and Fairy Tale and country musical songs that were made between 1971 and 1975. And it doesn't pick up again until Clee Francis in the late 90s for you. There's like 10 years of music that was not popularly heard. It exists. It was created. And it's okay. Well, I'm going to make all those records. Then if you come into country music after some point between Brad Paisley and Lil Nas X, there's all these records. You're like, weird. Like, I know Darius. I know this person. I know that person. I know Mickey Guyton, whatever. But where are the other records? Now they all exist. And they're just rolled out beautifully. 27 of them, in fact. And it's like, what comes next? God knows. But I'm sure it'll be another collection of music that fills in some more holes and makes Beyoncé as a singular artist the grand repository of the history of multiple generations of Black musical traditions.
So that's in your mind, that is the end game, as it were, to do almost a complete syllabus.
Yeah, she's the pop griot of all Black musical forms in popular musical in commercial conversation.
Well, when Beyoncé starts doing her 88 to 92 Texas rap album, I cannot wait for that. I'm really looking forward to it.
I'm waiting for the Tejano.
Yeah, real spit.
Give us the cumbia.
I need a Tejano Beyoncé record, and I need her in Scarface immediately.
Yes. Real spit.
And just make a
whatever.
Tape.
Like, that's yeah, like, same like record, a blues, honestly. Like make a blues record. Yeah, 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 absolutely. Yeah, like Scarface and Beyonce with Ramon Ayala. Like, yeah, yeah.
Clarence Gate Mouth Brown Records. I'm here for it. Let's go.
What a conversation. Thank you, Julianne. Thank you, Marcus. I appreciate y'all for coming through.
Dude, always.
Thank you.
Every podcast ever is available at nytimes.com/podcast. Every episode of Podcast Deluxe, that's me and Joe on YouTube at youtube.com/podcast. And subscribe anywhere you get your audio content, Apple, Spotify, YouTube, et cetera, et cetera. It's the podcast.myshopify.com is where the t-shirts and stickers are. Type podcast into Zazzle and you'll see the mugs and the baby onesies, because why not? If you have a baby, why wouldn't that be a podcast, baby? So go ahead and throw that on there. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Let's go out with a song we didn't really spend a lot of time on. And maybe it's just because it's just too vexing. Of all the songs on this record, why did Beyoncé choose to do a sensual duet with Post Malone? Some things in the world remain unknowable. This is Levi James.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.